Trump Tower selling Tiffany's air rights for that skyscraper. He has served as chair of both the real property section of the American Bar Association and the Anglo-American Real Property Institute, and published frequently in legal periodicals. Dave received his BA summa cum laude in American Studies from Yale College, followed by an MA with first class honors in modern history from Cambridge University, where he was a Keasley Fellow. He then received a JD in Yale Law, where his clinical trial witness was none other than Hillary Clinton. Dave is, like me, a Yale-aholic. You're not going to want to go through the 10-step withdrawal therapy. Before beginning law school, he spent the summer writing a history of the Yale Corporation at the request of the late president of Yale, Kevin Brewster, in order to find legal room for the administration to diversify the corporation. As a result, two women were added the next year. Fast forward, and Dave's become one of the world's top scholars on Rudyard Kipling, having written what is considered the definitive bibliography of Kipling's works, published in 2010 by the British Library. Confirmed Anglophile and bibliophile, Dave himself built a personal collection of Kipling books and manuscripts, which became the largest such collection in the world. That uniquely rich trove, Dave generously donated to Beinecke Library, where it rests permanently, available to Yale students and literary scholars. The catalog to the Beinecke exhibit of his collection in 2007 was published by Yale University Press. Tonight, Dave will talk about his new book, Skulls and Keys, The Hidden History of Yale Secret Societies, weighing in at a mere 821 pages. You can imagine the depth of research and the detail that Dave, under his nom de plume, David Allen Richards, has brought to the subject. He takes a fascinating look at the bonds created at these elite 15-member senior year clubs. Their initiates have gone on in the political world to be governors, ambassadors, Supreme Court chief justices, CIA directors, secretaries of state, war defense, and treasury, including Trump's, and of course, presidents. In the arts, they've won Pulitzer Prizes and Academy Awards and Emmys. At the university itself, philanthropists among them have gifted the first 12 residential colleges, Sterling Library, the Law and Divinity School buildings, and the Yale Center for British Art. But besides telling this history and recounting the society's remarkable legends and customs like Tap Day, his book also examines their progressive side that we rarely hear about, beginning in the 1930s and moving forward to the cultural tumult of the 60s. And the society's election of African Americans, women, and gays. Old friend, serious scholar, lover of books in Yale, and dare I say, a member of one of the six. Please welcome Dave Richards.
Over the course of more than two centuries. The senior year at Yale, this nation's third oldest college, has birthed and nurtured student associations called senior societies, whose fame has gone far beyond that of the typical college fraternities. Election to a senior society in New Haven occurs annually on one day in the spring, where groups of 15 seniors choose their successors in the junior class for clubs where the members' names may be public. New York Times began reporting the election results in 1886. But their subsequent activities in windowless, fortress-like buildings called tombs, very bright. These groups at Yale, Skull and Bones, Scroll and Key, Berzelius, all founded before the American Civil War, to be followed in succeeding decades by Book and Snake, Wolf's Head, Elegue, Manuscript, and after World War II, numerous underground societies of seniors without their own buildings are for good reasons more popularly known on campus and off as secret societies. But as you may not know, so too were their forebears, Phi Beta Kappa from 1778 on, most prominently among them. The statistical insignificance of the sample population and the brevity of the experience should consign the subject of Yale Senior Society membership to the dustbin of undergraduate nostalgia. Although a statistical sliver at 15% of their respective college cohorts in one college among, in time, hundreds in this country, these young men nevertheless went on to become among the most prominent leaders in all walks of American society. How did this happen? And since the election on the New Haven campus at age 19 or 20 became a frequent predictor of some future national prominence, the societies themselves became nationally famous. They figured in fiction by Stephen Vincent Manet, William Faulkner, Ernest Hemingway, John O'Hara, and John le Carré. The societies have featured in motion pictures like The Good Shepherd, Indiana Jones, and The Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, and that dreadful trilogy of thrillers, The Skulls. Their legends have been embellished in cartoons, including Doonesbury and The Simpsons. Now that shows Harvard graduate writers. I did say I'd mention some other institutions. That shows Harvard graduate writers made Homer Simpson's employer, C. Montgomery Burns, a retroactive member of the class of 1914, and Skull and Bones, and a roommate of Dick Stover of Stover Yale, America's most famous college novel. The fame of the secret societies of Yale College, or their detractors and notoriety, springs from the confluence of four circumstances of their existence. First is the large shadow cast by Yale in our country's political history for half the 19th and all the 20th centuries. The second is the sustained prominence over almost two centuries of the society's initiates in all phases of American life, about to be discussed here in more detail. And third, not to be overlooked, the proximity of New Haven to New York City, the nation's social, financial, and media capital, resulting in frequent press reports of society elections and the controversies surrounding it. The final circumstance, maybe why you're here, but that's all right, is the provoking secrecy maintained by their initiates after being tapped for membership, literally disappearing into tombs, windowless buildings, and a largely hidden culture which has given the American language new meanings, still current, for tapped, meaning to be chosen, and spook, meaning spy. In 2004, commenting on the presidential election that year, the New York Times entitled an article, "Nude Wrestling? Good Practice for Politics." This opening managed to marry the description of a legendary ritual of Skull and Bones, about which you were not here today, with the fact that this organization, with 800 living members, now had two of them, George W. Bush in the class of 68, and John Kerry, the class of 1966, the year ahead of me, running against one another for the leadership of the free world. Something similar had happened before, in 1965, when all three mayoral candidates in New York City, Robert Wagner Jr., John B. Lindsay, and William F. Buckley Jr., were also alumni of the two oldest Yale secret societies. Now, the Times article might have been wrong about the new press, but the second part was spot on. Membership in a senior society at Yale has long been both a reward for undergraduate leadership on the campus, a reward bestowed by outgoing seniors on upcoming juniors, not by the faculty, and a spur to further achievement after college life, inspired by illustrious alumni. All three of the presidents, American presidents who attended Yale College, William Howard Taft and the two Bushes, were members of the oldest senior society, and indeed were sons of members of that society. Besides Kerry and Bush, senior society members Sergeant Shriver of Scroll and Key and Joe Lieberman of Bellevue have been on major party presidential tickets in living memory. Furthermore, six of Yale's sons who became Secretaries of State, both of Yale's Supreme Court justices, three Attorneys General, three Secretaries of the Treasury, including the current one, two Secretaries of Defense, two Directors of the CIA, five United States Senators, and 10 state governors were all members of what became, over the years from 1833 to 1952, the seven above-ground societies. Now, by way of comparison with the Rhodes Scholarships, out of the 2,400 male Americans who were scholars between the founding of that famous program in 1902 and its inclusion of women in 1977, 75 years, we find only one U.S. president, one Secretary of State, one Secretary of Defense, one Attorney General, two CIA directors, five senators, one of them a secret society member, and one state governor, also a secret society member. And politics is only part of the story. Others of their annual delegations became among the most prominent leaders in law, literature, publishing, journalism, higher education, religion, finance, physical and social science, and philanthropy. Andrew D. White, Daniel Coit Gilman, and William Preston Johnston, the first presidents of Cornell, Johns Hopkins, and Tulane, respectively. Pulitzer Prize poets Stephen Vincent Benet and Archibald MacLeish. Geologists Benjamin Silliman Jr. and Lyman Spitzer, father of the Hubble Space Telescope. Football legends Walter Camp, father of American football, and Amos Alonzo Stagg. Names that will resonate before this audience, more than perhaps others I've spoken to, lawyers Henry Stimson of Winthrop Stimson, Frank Polk and Alan Wardwell of Davis Polk and Wardwell, and Thomas Thatcher of Simpson Thatcher, novelist John Hersey, and humorist Calvin Trillin, Henry Luce of Time and Life, Fortune, and Sports Illustrated, Brendan Gill of The New Yorker, Bill Buckley of The National Review, Bob Woodward of The Washington Post, Gary Trudeau of Truesberry, historians David McCall and Richard Rose, activists William Sloan Coffin and David Dellinger, FedEx founder Fred Smith, actress-director Jodie Foster, actor James Whitmore, and director George Roy Hill, all Academy Award winners or Golden Globe winners, Anderson Cooper of CNN, and Harvard professor Henry Louis Gates of PBS. The donors of Farnham Hall, Lawrence Hall, Phelps Gateway, Wright Hall on the old campus, and Payne Whitney Gymnasium. Philanthropists John Sterling and Edward Harkness, donors of the most and the most significant buildings on the Yale campus, and James Gamble Rogers, the architect of the Sterling Library, the law school, the 10 original residential colleges. We should note, incidentally, that Sterling's gift in current dollars is still the largest ever donation to Yale, more than the $250 million given to build the last two Yale residential colleges. And more philanthropists. David Engels, who gave the Engels Ring, Paul Mellon, who gave Morrison Stiles Colleges in the Center for British Art, and most recently, 2 years behind me, Steve Schwartzman, donor of the forthcoming Schwartzman Center, and, as an undergraduate, the head of the Yale Student Library. Seems to be a pretty good business trade. And every Yale University president between 1886, Timothy Dwight, and 1992, Benno Schmidt. Now, this assembly line for leadership has been functioning for almost two centuries. In 1893, Appleton's Encyclopedia of American Biography decided to do a census of the individuals it chronicled by occupation. And Yale College outstripped all its rivals, including Harvard, which was almost seven decades older, in the category of statesmen. The encyclopedia concluded, Yale seems to be more American than Harvard. Public life, politics, statesmanship represent a very important part of American life. Therefore, a larger number of distinguished men of Yale do we find in statesmanship than of Harvard. And the Harvard philosopher George Santayana wrote only a year before in the Harvard Monthly, "No wonder all America loves Yale, where American conditions are vigorous, American instincts unchecked, and young men are trained and made ready for the keen struggles of American life." Now, what connects these two late 19th century observations, Santayana's recognition that Yale men were trained and made eager for the keen struggles of American life, he's not talking about faculty contribution here, but about the fierce contribution of extracurricular pursuits. and the Cyclopedia's census of the results of that training in statesmanship is, I would maintain, the senior society system. And that's the hidden history of my book's subtitle. Not the hidden secrets, not the hidden boogie-woogie, the hidden history. Let's tease out two historical strands which get braided into our subject. First, from out of the Enlightenment in Europe came what Immanuel Kant called its motto, sapere aude, have the courage to use your own understanding. Meaning, not that of your social superiors, or the king, or the established church. Passing through the coffee houses of London and then entering in the port cities of the American colonies came the revolutionary notion of gatherings of non-aristocratic social equals within which could be conducted spirited debate on all sorts of topics. Secondly, because some of those topics were inherently dangerous, particularly the vast questions of politics and religion, the privacy of such gatherings, or if you will, the secrecy, became a necessity in permitting robust discussion for the initiated. Almost 50 years ago, the anthropologist Lionel Tyler, in his book Many Groups, told us that, quote, secret societies are the consequence of an effort of individuals, usually and mainly men, to create the social conditions for exercising their gregarious propensities, the expression of which may be, or may seem to be, inhibited by the community. Now, add to this the allure of exclusive membership and the rapid social elevation in the adult world of what became best known of such groups, the Masons, and you have, in the New World, all the ingredients for the blossoming of fraternities, which in early 19th century America, I suspect you don't know, were alternatively called, without opprobrium, secret societies, and which by mid-century were building windowless fraternity houses at brand new colleges. Now the first of these such societies to take permanent root in America at the College of William and Mary in still colonial Virginia in the late 18th century was Phi Beta Kappa, formed by some young men previously initiated into the brand new Masonic chapter in their college's city in 1776. This was not the scholarship organization which we know today. That dates only from PBK's reorganization as a scholarship honor society in 1984. But rather, it was a very social, and indeed very hard-drinking, collegians club, taking in about a third of the senior class. When those collegians decided that Phi Beta Kappa should, like the Masons, itself have chapters in other colonial colleges, there was, remember, as yet, no United States. This is still a revolution. They were delighted to learn that a Harvard graduate named Elisha Parley, who had spent his first 2 years at Yale and then transferred, was a tutor at a farm across the James River. They invited him over, swore him in to a secret club with a secret sign and a secret handshake and a blood-curdling oath against exposing those secrets. Parley protested that secrecy. It was much greater than anything he'd experienced at Yale in his literary debating society, Lanonia, the Lanonia now mentioned in Lanonia and Brothers, part of Sterling Memorial Library, known to most undergraduates today simply as L&B. Nevertheless, Parley agreed to be Phi Beta Kappa's missionary to his two alma maters, and he rode horseback north with two silver PBK keys and two charters, and with them he founded the Alpha of Connecticut at Yale, and about 6 months later, the Alpha of Massachusetts at Harvard. Lord Cornwallis and Benedict Arnold had meanwhile invaded the Tidewater and shut down William and Mary and Phi Beta Kappa there, leaving Harvard and Yale as the mother of Phi Beta Kappa chapters. But fast forward half a century, and Phi Beta Kappa, thanks to Harvard and Yale, boasted now other chapters, other alphas in Northeastern colleges, had dwindled to merely holding anniversary dinners. Conversely, the Masons in America had flourished, but become more controversial. When a former member threatened exposure of their secrets, he was murdered, wrapped in chains, and sunk to the bottom of Lake Niagara, with his murderers acquitted in a courtroom run by a Masonic judge and packed with Masons. So when, in 1832, the second edition of a tell-all book to expose the Masons was announced to be published in Boston, with a new 9-page appendix detailing, this is on the cover page, the secrets of Phi Beta Kappa, the graduate president of the Alpha Massachusetts, a man named Edward Everett, penned. Edward Everett, some of you may know, was a man who spoke after Lincoln at Gettysburg for 2 hours, the only thing for which he's remembered today. But Everett was vetted by the anti-Mason John Quincy Adams, and they orchestrated a vote to end secrecy in the Harvard chapter of Phi Beta Kappa, where, as always, the graduates outnumbered the students, and the vote ended the secrecy. But then Everett realized belatedly that in a fraternal organization, he just changed a fundamental rule. So he rushed down to New Haven the very next week, where he demanded the same thing happen at the Phi Beta Kappa anniversary there, where Chancellor Kent, the great New York jurist, was having his 50th reunion and was the speaker. The Yale alumni present, outnumbering the collegians, also voted to end secrecy. Now, the future valedictorian of the class of 1833, and then the undergraduate president of the Alpha of Connecticut, a man named William Huntington Russell, whose grave is in the Grove Street Cemetery in New Haven, and his Phi Beta classmates were upset and dismayed at losing their cherished secrecy. It meant something to them. So Russell, with Alfonso Taft, who was the third ranking member of the class, and later the president of Taft's father, four other Phi Beta Kappa members, and eight men who were not in Phi Beta Kappa, then formed a new group to have secret meetings. They called it, secretly, the Eulogia Club, that word being a back formation from the Greek for blessing. But when they posted the notice of their meeting on the chapel door, which Yaleys had to pass twice a day, for a long time after 1833, the new club secretary, to add some flair to his announcement, sketched at the notice's top a skull and bones. The classmates, their classmates, began calling the group Skull and Bones, which is its common name, but it's never been its official. Now, note that secrecy was its affect, not its purpose. This was the age of the, quote, self-made man, a term coined by Southern Senator Henry Clay in 1832, the year Skull and Bones was founded, to describe not what we know as the self-made man, the man who becomes rich, but the ability to perfect the self through sustained, concentrated efforts to improve the mind, morals, and body with an identity that was voluntarily chosen and consciously constructed. That was a self-made man. Now these, in the 1830s, were children of the Enlightenment, and they recognized in the rising nation that the way for them themselves to rise, to get out from behind their father's mule or his general store counter, was extemporaneous speech, which was required in the courthouse, or in the legislature, or in the bar, or in the pulpit. Now, Yale College did not teach extemporaneous speech, and the so-called debates at the ancient literary societies, or known in its rival society, Brothers in Unity, were assigned in advance, written out, memorized, and then delivered back against somebody who'd done the same thing. It wasn't a debate at all. So the Bone Society's program was to meet weekly, pick a topic at that meeting, didn't know it in advance, you voted on it, and then all 15 had to speak going around the circle with a 5-minute limitation rule imposed 32 years before the same rule was adopted by the American colonies. Now the prestige of Skull and Bones after its first decade, in a class of 110, where they're counting 15, provoked, just 10 years later in 1842, a rival called after the symbols on its badge, Skull and Peak. That was never its official title either. But it was a second group of self-elected 15 formed by juniors who felt worthy but passed over. And as the class size inexorably increased over the years, similar pressure led to the founding of Woolsey in 1883, just in time to head off a class vote, which was to petition the faculty for the senior society's extinction. The Yale News was founded shortly before, in 1878. It's America's oldest college newspaper, and it was actually started to torment the secret societies for the exclusive Indian areas. A fourth club, LAU, Joe Lieberman's group, was founded in 1904, and like its elder brothers, having 15 members, and like them, meeting weekly in its own building, although not a windowless stone tomb, but a former Revolutionary War tavern facing the New Haven Green, where the shutters were always closed. Now, when the 10 original residential colleges opened in early 1930s to house all of Yale College, funded by Edward Harkness, whose father had put up 15% for an entrepreneur named John D. Rockefeller, was to create for every undergraduate something like the social comfort and equality which Harkness had enjoyed in Woolshead. The old, and then when the colleges were built, the old Sheffield School Scientific Fraternities housing on campus was closed down, and the two oldest chef societies, Berzelius and Book and Snake, founded in 1848 and 1863 respectively, they had already built tombs in imitation of societies on the academic side of Yale College. And for their continued survival, they joined in the Tap Day ceremonies in 1934. So these, the so-called Ancient Six, all with prominent clubhouses, were styled appropriate to distinguish themselves from the even more clandestine groups called undergrounds, created with the return of the veterans from World War II. These did not publicly appear on Tap Day, the day of election for all the above grounds, and were known only to their memberships. Examples of these were that copying the names of Spade and Gray and Mason Chain. Another manuscript, explicitly founded as a seventh senior society, but particularly for the artistically inclined, think Jodie Foster, Anderson Cooper, David Gesellhauer, commenced as an underground in 1952 and soon came above ground, the last to do so, with a modernist tomb on Elm Street by 1963. The societies were not, as that 1883 vote to suppress them, unopposed on campus. Their exclusivity sometimes bred arrogance, and the daily sporting of their gold badges on their cravats, so you couldn't look at a member without having it advertised, offended non-members, who responded by booby-trapping the walkways to explode on the old campus when they walked back after their meetings, and defacing their tombs, and wiring their iron doors shut so they couldn't get out the next morning. Before they had tombs, Bones and Keyes' rented room suffered from mysterious fires in 1842. Both of them, and I can't prove that they were started by the same person, but they happened within 3 weeks of them. And later in the century, the tombs were vandalized on the outside and even broken into and searched on the inside. The invasion of the Bones tomb was an event reported and lamented in the Harvard and Princeton student newspapers in 1876. How outrageous the clubs of gentlemen should be accosted. In 1883, as I noted, a class meeting called for a vote to petition the faculty to abolish the senior societies, as the freshman and sophomore societies had already been suppressed for bad behavior. Sophomores in the class of 1915, Archie MacLeish's class, coalesced in an agreement not to show up for election in their junior year, to simply starve the seniors and candidates to elect. In 1941, the Army Air Corps, arriving on the Yale campus for wartime training, tried to commandeer the Bones tomb for a guardhouse. And it was private property, so that couldn't happen. And in 1950, 2 days before Tap Day, a bomb was exploded in front of that tomb. Sometimes the alumni corporate board themselves became angry at the graduates. For varying infractions, they locked out the members of manuscript in 1970. Out of Elihu in 1983, they wanted to invite everybody in on the green, which is just across the street. And out of Bones in 1991, because the undergraduates had dared to elect women without permission. And since election in their small numbers became the summit of a Yale College career, the societies were compelled to defend their exclusivity and the privilege of their privacy, their secrecy, by making election choices which were seen on the campus to be small d democratic, rewarding with the prestige of membership in their last year. You are tapped in May of your junior year. You don't come in until your senior year, which is one reason why the secrets don't leak, generally, except through divorced wives and things like that. Up until about 1970, through all these decades of the 19th and 20th centuries, the surest path to coveted membership was demonstrated leadership on the campus. Student standards, of course, changed with the rise of the extracurricular. Valedictorians and speech managers speech prize winners named by the faculty were joined by the student-elected captains and managers of crew, baseball, football, chairs of campus publications, heads of the prom committee, and members of the new singing groups. You could even openly disdain the societies for their arrogance and conformity and still be tapped. That is the narrative arc of the most famous of all American college novels, Stover Yale, 1911, where Dink Stover scorns the society system, but is still tapped by bullets in the last chapter. Now, their internal programs of twice-weekly meetings had expanded beyond the Thursday night debates, which I would argue led to the statesmanship within the next 50 years, celebrated by that encyclopedia I quoted, to personal presentation of life histories on Sunday nights, described by John O'Hara in his 1949 novel, A Rage to Live, inventing a senior society called Deathcap, and again by my classmate, gay pioneer Paul Manette, in his 1992 autobiography, Becoming a Man, which won the National Book Award. I say this on an evening when Angels in America is still in the previews, 3 years before Paul dies of AIDS. Thursday night, he wrote, would become our tribal night come autumn, when each of us would be required to present an autobiography to our 14 brothers. Elihu chose 4 Jews to be my brothers, and a Cuban, and an African-American to boot, Kel Melting Pot. More to the point, he chose 3 queers as well, though that would never be spoken aloud, even within the sanctum walls. I already knew I would lie when I told my story. This was to change rapidly. In 1975, Skull and Bones openly embraced a new diversity and confirmed its pattern of electing leaders when it tapped the president of the Gay Student Alliance. By 1988, a member of Keyes had said, it had become almost traditional to elect 2 gays annually. African Americans, Monette's story evidences, had been invited into the secret society system even earlier. Levi Jackson, the black football captain of the class of 1950, a New Haven high schooler whose father had been chief steward of the Yale faculty club, was tapped by both Bones and Keyes in 1949, although he had chosen to keep his pre-tap pledge to Brazilians. And by the class of 1970, African American and African blacks constituted over 10% of the membership of the 7 above grounds, which was a remarkable 2.5 times their demographic percentage, just over 4%, in the Yale student body, the class of 1021. Oddly, the last time that sort of statistical inversion had occurred was 150 years before, when the early delegations of Bones and Keyes were electing about twice as many Southern slaveholders' sons as their class percentage membership would have justified. Why? Because the greatest American orators of that pre-Civil War era were Southerners. Think John Calhoun, Robert Hayne of the Hayne-Webster debates, Jefferson Davis, and senior societies back then were salting their membership line to teach themselves extemporaneous speech. 5 of the 6 Confederate generals graduating from Yale College, fighting for the Confederate States of America, were members of Bones and Keyes. The head of the Mississippi Secession Convention was a Bonesman. The head of the Louisiana Secession Convention was a Bonesman. They chose their country or their state over their education or their university, but they were leaders 30 years old. As for women, first admitted to Yale in 1969, most of the senior societies made them members as soon as they were juniors, although the powerful national alumni of the 3 oldest, Bones, Keyes, and Woolsey, against their undergraduates' wishes, effectively blocked women's admission until 1991. The graduates simply didn't understand what it was like to be in a 50-50 gender-diversified Yale college. 100% white males would be great for them. The Bones Club of 1991, as I indicated, tapped them anyway and were rewarded for their chutzpah by being locked out of their tomb before a ballot of the national membership reversed that board decision. The spokesman for that club, the male spokesman, was Austin Goolsbee, who Obama's chief economic advisor in the first term. Now, almost all societies are gender balanced, and some indeed admit 16 instead of 15 to make it exactly equal. So, in the last half century, diversity, ethnic, religious, and gender, has become as or even more important in improving campus leadership than gaining membership. That is because while the weekly debating program persists in many groups, delivering life histories, autobiographies, have emerged as the most compelling feature of Yale Secret Society activity today. That practice began in Mullins after the Civil War, providing a Sunday night pastime to supplement Thursday night debates. Now I'm advised that some societies feature PowerPoint presentations by their members running for upwards of 6 hours. Now, why is that? I would argue that it is because in a much enlarged Yale College, with classes of 1,400 or more, it's not the University of Michigan, but it's a lot bigger than it used to be. What is missing in the form of curriculum or other campus activities, like extemporaneous speech was missing back in the 19th century day, is social and intellectual intimacy. Over 4/10 of the undergraduate population today consists of minority students. And in a university where a faculty member actually invented the term WASP, white American males, the overwhelming demographic preponderance of classes from Yale's founding until the 1950s, comprise only just over a quarter of current Yale undergraduates. So to get the most out of their time today in New Haven, I believe today's students have discerned that society membership provides an exhilarating experience in sharing that intimacy and learning from that diversity. When surveyed, only 12 juniors in the class of 2015 opted out of the selection process. Moreover, there are now at least 47 above ground and underground senior societies at Yale. The number comes from the annual Yale Daily News app, where the groups have to pledge publicly not to violate Connecticut anti-harassment laws. This means virtually half of the senior class are now members. Now, all this intellectual and social richness might have happened elsewhere, maybe at Harvard or Princeton, but it did not. Both those universities officially banned secret societies, which for them were fraternities, in 1857. Harvard was slightly smaller than Yale throughout the 19th century, and so geographically inbred, I love this part, that 3/4 of the boys could walk home to Sunday lunch. Now, what emerged there were the so-called final clubs, like Porcelli. Franklin Roosevelt later said that his failure to be elected there was, quote, the greatest disappointment of his life. When Theodore Roosevelt's daughter Alice married Nicholas Longworth, and Kaiser Wilhelm was invited to the wedding, Teddy pointed out to Willie that Nicky and he had been in pork, and Franklin had to stay outside when they had the private ceremony in the White House for the Porcelli. Now, only one today of the final clubs at Harvard has female members, and the Harvard administration is now proposing to choke them out of Cambridge college life because, among other things, of an alleged high incidence of sexual assault. At Princeton, what emerged were the eating clubs like Ivy and Cottage and Tiger Inn, where eating, a Princeton historian has written, was turned into a contact sport. These clubs have no intellectual activity at all, and in 1979, 10 years after most of the Yale Secret Societies admitted women, were pursued to the United States Supreme Court by an angry Princeton co-ed seeking membership. So, are the Yale Senior Societies secret? Mostly, although much has leaked out over the years from raided, stolen histories, and as I said, angry divorced wives, as my 800 pages show, doesn't have to be done again. And the names of those tapped are no longer published in the next days of the New York Times. Were the members at times snobbish and arrogant, and were spirits crushed, being passed over publicly on tap day when they gathered in one of the courtyards or on the old campus? No doubt. But have they ever been accused before the admission of women or after of improper conduct like that now contested at Harvard? Despite all the fevered conspiracy theories about them, did they ever cradle traitors in their midst, like Anthony Blunt and Guy Burgess of the fabled Student Society of the Apostles at Cambridge University? No, and no. And by the way, James Angleton was not a member of any secret society. And so his nickname, Mother, which was part of the title of the novel, The Organs from Mother, which talks about the secret societies, it was a suggestion or a combination which never was true for Angleton, but John le Carré makes the point in Rush House that the Yale secret societies had turned the CIA into a spook house. And much to their credit, they began not as mere social cliques, but as self-education societies. Bones with extemporaneous speech, and Berzelius in 1847 to read scientific papers that were not being provided by their Sheffield Scientific School professors. And they were small d democratic enough, these prep school wasps, to incorporate within their ranks Jews, Catholics, public high schoolers, who only outnumbered the preppies at Yale in 1969 or 63, my freshman year, blacks, women, and LGBT classmates decades before either Yale University and its administration or faculty, or indeed the United States and this country's establishment, were to similarly recognize, celebrate, and elevate personal excellence in castes outside the powerful world of Christian Caucasian males. So whatever one's opinion of them, these small student clubs, beginning in the 1830s and 1840s during the Romantic movement in American arts and letters, to this day operate on the patently romantic proposition that the discovery of an inner authentic self learned through your clubmates and in debates and discussions with them both corresponds and advances the aim of forming an ideal community. That experience has been the mortar as strong as that binding together the stones of the society students, that's held the secret society system together for almost two centuries against those, on campus and off, who sought to do away with it, the seeming privilege and undoubted exclusivity. In his biography of Henry L. Stimson, Yale class of 1888 and Bones, Harvard historian Elting Morrison tells us Stimson's remarkable public career, U.S. District Attorney for the Southern District of New York, Secretary of War under President Taft, Governor General of the Philippines under President Coolidge, Secretary of State under President Hoover, and Secretary of War again under Presidents Roosevelt and Truman. He writes of Yale and Stimson's senior year, quote, "They constructed in the senior societies, with admirable insight, a mechanism to mobilize the emotions of the selected few to their high purposes. Exactly how this was done, how in 9 months, in weekly meetings, in secret places, whole lives were changed, is past all discovery. Such special election produces no doubt," he goes on, "a sense of large responsibility. The compressions of the secret can generate great energy. At any rate, for most of those engaged, it worked." In his last recommendation in public service, Henry Stimson proposed that the country should share the knowledge and control of nuclear energy for peaceful purposes with Russia. He made this proposition, he told President Truman, because, quote, "The chief lesson I've learned in a long life, that the only way you can make a man trustworthy is to trust him." He'd said the same thing often before, his biographer tells us, and usually when he said it, he added that he'd learned that thing first when he committed himself to membership in his secret society. Today, it is not as in Stimson's time only white Protestant males who are learning to trust each other within these societies, but every ethnicity and gender to be found in the modern Yale undergraduate population. They just don't know to whom they owe that opportunity, or how it came about in the beginning, or even that they live and study in a campus mostly built by the donations of secret society alumni. Thank you for listening. I'd be happy to take some questions. Sir?
Yeah. Question, is the current Yale administration trying to curtail the secret societies in any way?
The current Yale administration, if you don't get tapped, you can call them and they will help you get in for one of these undergraduates. that's how much they are happy with them. There are some concern about the older undergrounds that many of which absolutely ban alcohol. The oldest fraternity house in the United States, this is called the Bones Too, and when the alumni built it, it was built on condition that alcohol never passed the gates. Some of these newer groups may be less inhibited, and most of these older secret societies have 501c3 exemptions, tax exemptions, as educational institutions. And if they are overwhelmed by a group of other societies that seem to be the same but are not, there is some current fear that tax status might change. But no, the Yale administration has no desire to do it, although fraternities are still bad actors. Delta Kappa Epsilon is got a Title IX problem right now again, and fraternities have been in and out of favor over the years. But the societies have not had that problem. And the men were terrified when the women began to be admitted. My book is dedicated, among others, to Maynard Mack, a great English professor who wrote the official history of Scroll and Key. And according to their official history, Mack gave a speech to the first club of a delegation of Scroll and Key and women, encouraged them to be sovereign states and not to make alliances. And of course, what he was saying is, please speak together, it's going to mess everything up. And so I think that was part of the fear. The undergraduates who were powerful graduate alumni in the 60s, remember the 40s and 30s when Yale was all male, and they were very worried about that. And my experience is it's like looking at a bunch of puppies. I mean, they're just leaning up against one another. There seems to be a bit of a prophylactic, social prophylactic, if you're brushing your teeth in the same bathroom. As far as I know, in my group, only one man and woman have ever married. That doesn't seem to have been a problem. There have not been public episodes of problems, whereas the Harvard Final Clubs, having all males, have parties for women trying to get in and are admitted, as they might be a fraternity party, and apparently things happen. So Yale managed to misstep.
Sir? How did the number 15 per year get determined? Has there been a discussion of increasing relative to the increasing population in the schools?
Well, they all had 15 after Skull and Bones, because Skull and Bones had 15. I'm just as good as you are. I'm just as exclusive. And it's a little bit like Protestant denominations. We may, worship the same God, but I didn't think I would. I don't know. I can never find out. Bones had 14 the first year, 15 the second year, 10 years later, Skull and Bones started with 15, and everybody did it after that. I have a speculation in the book. There were three terms at Yale at the time, and the top five boys in each of the three terms were invited to be the tutors in Yale College in the 1840s and 1850s. And I think it may have been a smart-aleck way to say, these are our 15. You didn't choose them. We chose them for what we thought was their personal excellence, not their gifts in Latin and Greek. That's a speculation. So the pattern was set by Bones. In the first Bones catalog, there were 14 names. When they tapped or elected the next group, it was 15, and it stayed 15. And rules grew up around that. There were to be no chapters at other colleges. They were not to replace anybody that left. People have quit over the years, particularly in the tumultuous end of the 60s. Might get down to 12 or something like that. But there was never an election to go beyond 15, and what I understand is now the groups of 16 were to accommodate so they could be perfectly gender balanced. That's my best guess, is a guess. Sir?
Yeah, I heard that when, in the good old days, when the chef was still existing, there were certain secret societies that wouldn't allow men that were part of the chef to join them, and they would have to join other societies like Brasilia?
I don't know that. I do know that the African American stewards, they were called lamplighters, in the first groups, were made honorary members, and when they died and were buried in the Grove Street Cemetery, the members were the pallbearers. So, and Bones's lamplighter wrote for an abolitionist newspaper, and William Huntington Russell, the founder of Bones, was a trustee of John Brown after he was hanged. So I've never found any particular discrimination there. The jokes tend to be, what do you do when the fire department comes? You swear them in and let them in. So one hears stories of that kind of thing. And of course, if you're putting in the kitchen or the plumbing, obviously they have to deal with tradesmen. I never heard that the chefs had to be members of something else. They had to be there. You get fed twice a week. And the early stewards were highly honored.
No, the Sheffield Scientific.
Oh, chef? Oh, the I'm sorry.
That was a good answer. That's an excellent answer.
Short.
Sheffield Scientific School was Yale's agricultural land grant college.
Yeah.
Basically, Yale did a number on the American Congress and set up the Sheffield Scientific School. That was a 3-year course, and they had fraternities there, and they had houses, some of which are still there, where the boys slept in them. But the Sheffield Scientific School students were on the chef side and could not be tapped for the academic side. In 1933, when the college system came in, and everybody had to live in a Yale college, and Yale bought the fraternities, the sleeping quarters, they had two, it was Berzelius and Book and Snape, they'd already built, and they joined Tap Day. And so from 1933 on, you had all of them. But no, prior to that time, there was a line,
yeah.
Academic looked down on chef. Somebody once said Arthur Hadley was like Franz Joseph as the head of Austria and Hungary, joined only by the crown. So they were sort of poor cousins. But when they came in 1933, one of the things I found was a wonderful newsletter from Woolstead to its alumni saying, you know, these kids think Berzelius and Book and Snape have been here forever. This is terrible. They don't understand that, you know, we were greater for 50 years before that, so you need to tell us who we are at Tap. Because the knowledge of a college student is he comes in, whatever's there has always been there. And they very quickly came in. The problem with new societies, like the undergrounds or like Manuscript, or in the early years, LU wouldn't join Captain. You didn't want to come up short of that 15. That was humiliating. So they would, LU for 10 years, chose people after Tap Day, men who had been passed over. Manuscript was told not to come out on Tap Day, to wait. And they did, but by that time, and particularly where they were known as being for artistic students, the ones that I mentioned before, they certainly, in a Yale that was then admitting more students of that kind, had no problem. Sir?
I hope I don't have the wrong architect, but every so often I think William Wells Osler is cited as speculatively as the architect of the Skull and Bones.
No, it's a man named Austin, and he used the floor plan, and those papers are now, thanks to me, digitized in the Yale library. But the original art gallery at Yale was the Trumbull Art Gallery, so you may know that, and it was windowless. And the condition was that John Trumbull and his wife be buried there. And they had been reburied 3 times as this thing moved around. But the artistic notion of a temple, a windowless temple, the floor plate, the floor plan for the Trumbull Gallery, and if you go up to the top of Phelps Gate in the summertime, you look down, you can see the green grass where it was in the 1850s, was used for Skull and Bones. What is now Skull and Bones is tripled in size. Originally, if you face it, it was just the building on the left. And in 1903, they doubled that to the right and then added something in the middle. So that was an undistinguished architect, although reasonably well known, but the Scroll and Key building was done by Hunt, who did the Metropolitan Museum, Richard Martin Hunt. And Wolf's End was done by Bertram Broker Goodhue, who did the LA Public Library, the Nebraska State House, the Grolier Club here, who would have done the Yale College system, except he died in 49 of a heart attack. And Harkness, his favorite architect was J. Gamble Rogers. And James Gamble Rogers wanted to do the new tomb. The old tomb of Wolf's Head is now at the corner of Trumbull and Prospect. And was done by McKim Mead White. The only McKim Mead White building on the Yale campus, and the floor plans are up in the New York Historical Society where I looked at them. And Gamble Rogers wanted to do the second, closer to the campus, tomb for Wolf's Head. But Harkness is a member of Wolf's Head. I talked about this with Paul Goldberg, who was also a member of Wolf's Head. Said he thinks that Harkness's head was going to explode, that a member of Scroll and Key was going to do the tomb of Wolf's Head. Could have happened. So James Gamble Rogers did all the fraternity buildings that now go up Fraternity Row, and did the 10 original colleges. But again, you've got with the Bones Tomb, Greco-Roman, and it looks a little bit like the entry, for those of you who know it, of the sandstone entry to the Grove Street Cemetery. The dead shall rise. Someone once said they will if the end wants the land. And the Scroll and Key building, which is the most, I say it as both the most beautiful fraternity house in the United States, done by Hunt, is a Saracen Arabic Alhambra-type structure with colored bricks. And again, no windows. So they're rather remarkable pieces of architecture. And obviously unique today, where we don't encourage that kind of secrecy, whereas in the 19th century, there were hundreds of thousands of Americans who were members of secret groups, which wore fezzes and other gear, but secrecy was done. So that's the story there. All the way in the back.
Are the programs of the Above Ground Society all essentially the same?
I don't think so. I got invited to Manuscript to talk to them last week. That's the only other group I've ever been in, only other building I've ever been in. I don't think Scroll and Key has the debates anymore, although they started out that way. I think their common thread now, although some, certainly Bones still has debates, are the life histories that I told you about, and the younger ones in a new century are much more open to inviting guests from the outside, the way Manuscript did me, or they have faculty members who have become advisors over the years. And so their programs are a little more expanded. So I think debates to a lesser extent than in the 19th century, and then these oral histories, oral personal histories, and then other presentations by guests or faculty would be my guess. Ma'am?
Do you recount your own experience in the senior society in your book?
No.
You don't?
I do not.
Can you say what you found most valuable, maybe surprising, but most valuable about it?
The way they began to work, and the news, Daily News, Yale Daily News would beat up on those hits all the time. If you were picking the football captain and the head of Dwight Hall, the Christian YMCA group, and the speech guy, and a wicket group, how did these people get along? I only knew 3 of the 15 when I got there. And because of a couple of shared experiences. And for a while, Scroll and Key went the other way. They started to, because they couldn't always get the best men, because Bones had a little more prestige, they emphasized the set of men. So the notion was, if you were obnoxious as a football captain, Bones would take you. If you were obnoxious, not obnoxious, if you were a gentleman as a football captain, Keys would take you. They wouldn't take you if you were obnoxious. And so I think the most interesting thing that feeds into this diversity that I'm talking about now, which I think the kids might have tried, is was a bit of a Rhodes Scholar notion. Rub them up against one another. This was Cecil Rhodes' notion. And maybe 40 years on, when they're about to go to war, they talk to one another. They understand something about one another. So you don't come through necessarily telling all your secrets, as Monette said in that striking quote that I made. Although sexual histories tend to be part of the life histories now, which was one of the reasons that Wells alumni were terrified. And I've not heard one of those when women were in. And you don't come through finding them all your best friends. You see things, I did, see things in them I don't much like in myself. So I knew this person, but I didn't necessarily like them. And then others I became extremely close to that I never would have met in a class of over 1,000 and that they were in my group. And I think the diversity, even in my time and Monette's description for Jews, three LGBT, although not out in 1967, a Cuban, gives you some notion of what the seniors thought would be useful in the experience. And there are those who have termed it, and how Taft termed it, a religion. It is a deep emotional experience. And if it were bigger than 15, it probably wouldn't work. It's what Chris Argyris, in my time, the industrial relations professor, would call a T group, what we in the 60s called T groups. It's about that size. And it seems to work. Because you're together 6 hours on a Thursday night, 6 hours on a Sunday night, and who knows how many other times. Intimacy is invited, sometimes it's achieved. But I think understanding is probably the best thing to get out of it.
Maybe one more question?
Sure. Sir?
I was going to ask you, so how important is sort of relationships between older alumni and other alumni, a place like Skull and Bones, in sort of supporting people's careers and also increasing their influence in society's long-term?
One of the great legends, which I have to puncture in the book, is that if you join Skull and Bones, you get $10,000 immediately. Actually, in novels that recently come out, it's $20,000. There's an inflation factor. And one of the things I discovered was where that came from, which is when John Sterling had his will published in the New York Times in 1915, he left the sum of $10,000 to the so-called Russell Trust Association. And over the years, everybody's forgotten that, and they think it's individually as $10,000. Sadly, it is not. But something does happen to you, and I will tell you this story from inside. I went to a meeting in 1967 in which the treasurer of Yale, a member of the class of 1949, was present. And he told how in his year, Henry Stimson had been there. And how Henry Stimson had told them that when he was a member in 1885, William Russell, who founded Bones in 1833, was there. And yes, you've got pictures of people on the wall and my one other story, my most exciting moment was the night of the senior speech contest, which is called the DeForest. And Andrew Dixon White won it, Henry Luce won it. The Civil War veteran managed to survive by taking a gold medal instead of $100 and a bullet stopped by the gold medal. I had to compete. And that was the night that Archibald MacLeish was coming to visit us. And I came back late. And I apologized for being late. And I had my little copy of J.B. and so on. And he asked where I had been. And I told him. he signed the book. And I'll remember my children's names after I forget that, but it'll be close. It'll be close. So yes, that it's very inspiring. These are graduates who have gone out in the world and done well, and Yale is proud of that, and you feel that. But you feel other things as well. I was tapped by the club that included Fred Smith, FedEx, and John Kerry, and Nick Pershing, grandson of Blackwell. And 9 months later, his picture was up on the wall because he died as a second lieutenant, as many second lieutenants did, going off the meeting into the war and being on point. And you can't help but feel all of that. There's no question. Does it help? Yes, you will find a lot of people in George W. Bush's administration who were close members of other years, George H.W. Bush's administration, Gifford William Howard Taft, although he fired Gifford Pinchot, who was also a member of Paul's, but it's not perfect. And it's not always legacies. George W. Bush's daughter was not Taft. And legacies are not permanent, but certain. But certainly, you have a feeling. Thank you all very much.